You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now present Salvationists from the Jews with Roy Shulman.
Hi, this is Roy Shulman, and welcome once again to Salvation is from the Jews, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the completion, the fulfillment, the full realization of all of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. Now, today I wish to do with this show something that I've done a few times in the past, which is to play a talk by another enthusiastic Jewish convert to the Catholic Church, Dr. Larry Feingold, who is a professor at Kendrick Seminary. And it is on the topic of matrimony, beginning with matrimony in the Old Testament and under the Old Law in Judaism, and going on to the full realization of matrimony as a holy sacrament in the Catholic Church. And I think it'll be obvious why I am choosing this topic for today's show, since the sacrament of matrimony and the very concept of marriage is under attack as it has never been before in the civilized world. So without further ado, let me bring on the recording of a talk that Dr. Feingold gave to the Association of Hebrew Catholics on holy matrimony. I hope you enjoy it.
So our talk tonight is on the sacrament of matrimony. So, matrimony in the family stands at the center of human society as the first natural society created by God at the beginning, at the moment of creation. As the first and vital cell of all society. And the prototype of every social order. Right? So every kind of society looks to matrimony as its kind of model. And we could say one of the great missions of the church today is defending the sacrament of matrimony and the family in the face of all kinds of attacks that increasingly are threatening it. Everyone comes into being in the cradle of a family of some kind. And thus it's the primary place in which we become human and become more human. Back in 50 years ago at the Second Vatican Council, the Council in its document Gaudium et Spes speaks about the grave attacks on the family. So it says, the well-being of the individual person and human society is intimately linked with the healthy condition of that community produced by marriage and the family. And yet the excellence of this institution is not everywhere reflected with equal brilliance. Since polygamy, the plague of divorce, so-called free love, and other disfigurements have an obscuring effect, right? So these would be the attacks on the family. In addition, the document says, married love is too often profaned by excessive self-love, the worship of pleasure, illicit practices against human generation. And that's a reference there to contraception. Moreover, serious disturbances are caused in families by modern economic conditions and the demands of civil society, which doesn't always help the family, but often works against it. John Paul II has a great document on the family, marriage and the family, called Familiaris Consortio, that he wrote in 1981. It was after a synod of bishops called to study the family and what the church can do to defend it, marriage and the family. And John Paul II, as in so many of his writings, he begins by looking at the signs of the times and looking at, well, what's positive in the world with regard to marriage and the family and what's negative. And so there are some positive things. He says, for example, there's a more lively awareness of personal freedom. So it used to be centuries ago that most marriages perhaps were arranged. And so there wasn't that sense of freely entering into it and seeking the unit of good. So he says there's a more lively awareness of personal freedom and greater attention to the quality of interpersonal relations in marriage. So that would be a something positive. And promoting the dignity of women. So feminism, rightly understood, responsible procreation and the education of children. But the negative aspects are more visible, and we could say far more visible. And that would be, he says, a mistaken concept of the independence of the spouses. Because if each spouse is seeking self-fulfillment, that will go against the unity, simply, of the marriage. So a kind of sense of personal autonomy. Serious misconceptions regarding the relationship of authority between parents and children. The idea that children should decide what they want to receive from their parents. Concrete difficulties the family experiences in transmission of values. How to basically the idea that it's not our mission to transmit values to the children, but they'll choose themselves. The growing number of divorces, the scourge of abortion, ever more frequent recourse to sterilization, and the appearance of a truly contraceptive mentality. Right, these are the challenges, and they're all linked together in what could be seen as a false notion of freedom. That's one of the main themes of John Paul II in many different writings, that modernity has a notion of freedom that's essentially negative. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. In other words, freedom simply as freedom from, all too often, responsibility. Freedom from the law. Freedom from even the law of God. So he says, and therefore freedom from commitment. He says, at the root of these negative phenomena, there frequently lies a corruption of the idea and the experience of freedom, conceived not as a capacity for realizing the truth of God's plan for marriage and the family. That would be the positive sense of freedom. Freedom for. And so freedom is fundamentally, first and foremost, freedom for. It's the freedom to do God's plan in a personal way. That's the idea of freedom. And in order to do that, I have to be free from obstacles to that. So freedom has both a for and a from. But modern culture puts the from first. So he says, we conceive it of as an autonomous power of self-affirmation, often against others for one's own selfish well-being. Let's look now at, so these are kind of the contemporary perspective. Let's look at the nature of marriage. Now, but before I look at the nature of marriage, why is there such a thing as marriage? And to get at this, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. In order to understand all the sacraments, when we started with the sacraments back at the beginning of this series, we saw that God instituted sacraments because of man's nature, being a rational animal and knowing things first by senses, and then from the senses grasping universal and spiritual truths. And so it's man's nature to come to the spiritual through the sensible. And even before that, God gives us sacraments that involve both the sensible and the spiritual dimension on the image of human nature, which is both sensible and spiritual, and those two aspects united. So man's a substantial union of body and soul, of the sensible and physical and spiritual, and we come to the spiritual through the sensible. Right? That's man's nature. And so we saw in all the sacraments, God gives us grace through sensible means because that's fitting human nature. We come to the spiritual through the sensible, even in the supernatural order. And that's true very much so with regard to marriage. One of the main themes of John Paul II's theology of the body is that God's plan is to make his invisible love manifested through the mirror of human love. and precisely through spousal love. And so he's wished, he's created marriage at the beginning to be something that represents the divine love. But in order for human love to represent the divine love, human love has to be in accordance with the divine plan. And that plan is that there's a double symbolism. The divine love is manifested in human spiritual love, the spiritual love of the spouses, by which they completely give themselves to each other spiritually over the course of their marriage. But that spiritual love is manifested also physically in the act proper to the spouses, the conjugal act. So there's a double symbolism. The conjugal act represents conjugal love, and that represents the divine love. In other words, conjugal love, the love of the spouses for each other, in a spiritual way, is the human imitation of the divine love, and the conjugal act is the physical manifestation of that spiritual love. And therefore, in order for this symbolism to work, conjugal love has to have certain properties by which it will represent the divine love, and likewise the conjugal act will have to have those same properties. Otherwise, it won't represent, but it will do the opposite, hide or de-manifest, which we say, simply hide the divine love. And so the key idea is that since this is a sacred reality, divine love, human spousal love and the conjugal act have a sacred quality as being privileged means of representing the divine love. All right, hopefully this will become more clear as we go on. Now, in order to understand marriage, we have to look at Genesis 1 and 2, and especially Genesis 2. And so this is what John Paul II did in his Wednesday catechesis that we call the Theology of the Body. And this was a cycle of Wednesday talks that he gave for, I forget exactly how many years, but something like 5 years. And they form a unity. They start with Genesis, well, really with scripture on marriage. It starts with Jesus' response when he was questioned about divorce. And Jesus, in his response, said, well, it was not so in the beginning. So Jesus refers back to Genesis 2, the institution of marriage. And so he dwells on that for about a year. And the ending of the Theology of the Body is where what we'll look at later, an explanation of why contraception is contrary to God's plan. So he, in order to get there, why contraception is disordered, first you have to look at, well, what is marriage and what are its properties based on the very creation of man? In other words, you have to lay down a foundation to understand the church's teaching on contraception. So that's what John Paul II does in the Theology of the Body. And at the beginning, when he looks at Genesis 2, he spends several Wednesdays speaking about Adam's experience of solitude before Eve was created. And we might ask, well, why did God do it that way? Because it seems kind of odd. He made Adam first, and Adam, it was not good for Adam to be alone, and what does God do then? He doesn't immediately make Eve. He makes cows and horses and rabbits and brings them to Adam, and Adam names them and doesn't find a companion fit for himself. And so precisely in naming the animals and seeing his difference from them and recognizing that they're not spiritual, he comes to recognize his own solitude. And that's a good thing, actually. I mean, the solitude is a bad thing, but the recognizing one's solitude without his spouse is a good thing, because it shows it's a recognition of what he's for, that he's for giving himself to another, and if he doesn't find that other, he experiences a fundamental lack of fulfillment. So at last, when Eve is created, Adam says, or exalts, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh." Now we might wonder, well, Adam at the beginning had God. The Genesis tells us that, at least we see after the sin, Adam hid at the time in which he would walk with God in the cool of the evening. And that's a kind of metaphor, that walking with God in the cool of the evening, for a friendship with God. And this is why the Catholic doctrine teaches that Adam and Eve were created in a state of grace, because we can't have friendship with God without grace. So we can see that Adam and Eve were in grace. They had this friendship with God, and therefore, even before Eve was created, Adam was in friendship with God. So we might wonder, well, if he has had God as friend, why was it not good for him to be alone? Because he wasn't totally alone. And I think we can answer this using that principle we gave before. It's man's nature that we come to understand spiritual things through sensible things. And so it's proper for man to come to understand the divine love only through experiencing first human love. And Adam, before the creation of Eve, didn't experience that. And so he didn't have analogies to understand the divine love without understanding first human self-giving. Because we naturally understand the divine self-giving on the analogy of marriage and of human self-giving and human marriage and parenthood. And so, in order to understand God in a human way, Adam needed the experience of experiencing spousal love first. And this is why marriage, right from the beginning, we could say was the primordial sacrament. Sacrament in the sense of a sacred sign representing something bigger than itself. So right from the beginning, human marriage, that self-giving between Adam and Eve, was understood as a sign of God's total self-giving to man. And not only was it a sacred sign of that giving, but marriage in Eden would also have been a transmitting of grace. Because in Eden, before the fall, in the garden, the marital act would have transmitted not only human nature, as it does today, but also grace. Because children born in Eden would have been conceived in grace, just as Adam and Eve were created in grace. But since that original state was lost, marriage no longer transmits grace in that way that it would have in Eden. But it still remains always a sacred sign of the divine love. And so Adam's exulting when Eve was created would have been him understanding that he was for another. And therefore, he was made for giving himself as a gift to Eve and vice versa. And so that original unity in which Adam exulted would have been the experience of a mutual self-giving that was complementary. Adam to Eve and Eve to Adam. And thus, John Paul II speaks of this union as carrying within it a particular awareness of the meaning of the body in the reciprocal self-gift of persons. In other words, that this gift that they were to make to one another involves both the spirit and the body, and in precisely in that unity. And therefore, conjugal love and the conjugal act as the expression of conjugal love. Now, when Jesus was asked about marriage, we said he refers back to the beginning. In the beginning, it was not so with regard to divorce. Have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female? For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two become one. And in that becoming one, we can connect it with Genesis 1, verses 27 and 28, where God gives his first commandment to them. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. And that would be the primordial commandment, to be fruitful. And so from these texts, Genesis 2 and Genesis 1, we can see the fundamental properties of marriage as it will exist through all the ages. And so what are these properties? Well, we see that it's an exclusive union. Adam gives himself fully to Eve and Eve to Adam, and there aren't third parties. And we see that they're complementary. Adam and Eve are of opposite genders, and thus there's a complementary union between them. The union is indissoluble, and so that's why Jesus says, in the beginning it was not so, and what God has joined together, let not man set asunder, and that union is formed by a personal act of self-giving. And we could say a personal act of free consent to giving oneself in that way that can't be taken back. And so it has to be, marriage is created is created by God when he makes human nature, but each individual marital bond is created by the spouse's consenting to give themselves in that total way. And that consent involves a self-gift that's total, involving mutual service to one another and involving an openness to life. And therefore the mission, at least potentially, of procreation and education. And so those are the fundamental properties that we see in Genesis 1 and 2. And we could synthesize all those properties in one idea. Total gift of self. Now, we give of ourselves not just in marriage, but also in friendship, in religious life, and many other other kinds of societies than just marriage. But what's proper to marriage is that it involves a total gift. And it's that totality that gives to marriage those properties that can't be taken away from it. And it's precisely because of the totality that it mirrors the divine love, which is total. Right? So God's infinite love is mirrored most on earth by a love that is similarly total and therefore spousal. And that means if it's total, that it can't be taken back, right? Because if it's total, I don't retain what I've totally given, and therefore I can't retract, because that would have made it only a partial gift, only a temporary gift. And likewise, it has to be exclusive, because I can't give myself totally to 20 individuals or even two. And it has to be fruitful, because if I hold back my fruitfulness, say if I hold back paternity or maternity, I'm not giving a total gift, but only a partial gift. And so the totality of the gift means that it has to be ordered to life, because that's part of the totality that's being given, the gift of paternity and maternity. So a couple that, say, plan to, contracept throughout their married life, they obviously wouldn't be giving themselves totally to each other. And the same would be true even in one act. The conjugal act wouldn't be the sign of a total giving if it were deliberately frustrated of its fruitfulness. We'll come back to that. And in order to be fruitful, that conjugal love has to be complementary, because God has blessed complementarity with fruitfulness. And we'll come back to that also. And so all we could say, all the fundamental properties of marriage come from the fact that marriage has to have these properties in order to be a total gift. And anything less than that, anything different from that, simply wouldn't be a total gift at all. Now, we're capable of this, a total gift, because we're made in the image and likeness of God. And that's what distinguishes us from other creatures who aren't in the image of likeness, who can't make a gift of themselves. A horse can't make a gift of himself at all, because in order to give yourself, you have to possess yourself. In other words, only a free creature can give of himself. And therefore, only man and the angels can give of themselves in that way, because it requires self-dominion, which is a property of being rational. Right, so it's something that only that a man is capable of by being in the image and likeness of God, and it's precisely the way in which we realize one of the ways in which we realize that image by mirroring the divine love. Or we could say more in general, a total self-gift is the fullest way by which we mirror that divine love, and a total self-gift can be given in two ways. We'll see. Directly to God, that would be religious life, celibacy for the sake of the kingdom, or sacramentally, and that would be marriage, as representing that self-gift totally to God, sensibly, on the natural order, or elevated to the supernatural order by grace. Paul VI has in his encyclical on the immorality of contraception, Humanae Vitae, his most controversial encyclical and very great encyclical, he's in the course of explaining why contraception is wrong, he speaks about the properties of marriage. And he says that marriage involves the marital love, conjugal love, involves a love which is total. Now that's the key idea we're saying here. A love that is total is at the bottom of page 4. That very special form of personal friendship in which husband and wife generously share everything, allowing no unreasonable exceptions and not thinking solely of their own convenience. Whoever really loves his partner loves not only for what he receives, but loves that partner for the partner's own sake, content to be able to enrich the other with the gift of himself. So that's the essence of marriage, is that it involves this total self-gift. And we could say that this has five properties that we mentioned before. Every marriage has to be fully human. It has to be a human personal act created by the free consent of the spouses. It has to be indissoluble, otherwise it won't be total. It has to be exclusive, otherwise it won't be total. It has to be fruitful, again, otherwise it wouldn't be total. And in order to be fruitful, it has to be complementary between a man and a woman. All right, let's take these in order. Let's start with fully human. So we could say that because man is a personal creature created in the image of God, his procreation, right, the procreation of the human race, has to be accomplished in a personal way. In other words, in a way proper to someone made in the image and likeness of God, and thus different from the propagation of, I don't know, horses or rabbits. Right? So human sexuality will have to be exercised in a way proper to one capable of making a gift of himself. And thus, human sexuality has to involve the harmony between the physical and the spiritual aspect of gift. In other words, the physical self-gift has to be a mirror of the spiritual self-gift. So we could say that sexuality in human persons can never be separated from the personal and spiritual dimension. And sexual sins will be precisely attempts to make that separation. And man, we see in Genesis 2 that man from the beginning is a spousal creature. In other words, Adam was ordered to that gift to Eve and encountered frustration until Eve was created. And Eve likewise was ordered to a gift to Adam. And that's written into our nature. And it remains in our nature even if we are called to a different state in life. And so, likewise, the religious remains a spousal creature. And that's very important for understanding their own religious life, because religious life will involve a spousal gift, but made to Christ and to God. And so man, every man, is a spousal creature in that sense. Now, we said that in order to be total, the gift has to be irrevocable. And we see that again, both in marriage and in religious life. That's the beauty of a permanent vow, by which you give yourself totally, and it can't be retracted. And the same is true in marriage. So if it's not indissoluble, marriage would never be total. Right? So wanting to have a marital union that's dissoluble simply is not wanting to get married. Right? Because the very nature of wanting to make a total gift is wanting to make it in such a way that you can't retract it. And so really, admitting the possibility of divorce is not admitting the possibility of total self-gift. Right? And this is why the church defends the indissolubility of marriage, despite so many objections, so many pressures in the world to redefine marriage so as to conceive it as potentially dissoluble. But that would be to deny the very existence of a total gift. For better or worse. Right? The beauty of the marital gift is precisely those words, I do for better or worse. Right? In other words, that's what makes the gift have such a beauty. Because you're giving, even though potentially it might include, that gift might include great sacrifice and hardship, potentially. And that makes the value of the gift so beautiful in the eyes of God, and even in the eyes of your spouse. Yeah. And the same thing is true of the exclusivity. Right? So again, polygamy, by its very nature, is contrary to the nature of a total self-gift. So John Paul II has a beautiful section in Familiaris Consortia, where he defends the indissolubility of marriage. And he says that the only place in which this self-giving in its whole truth is made possible is marriage. So it's the only way you can really give a total gift of yourself is in marriage, understood in the way that we've said, indissoluble, exclusive, and ordered to fruitfulness. The institution of marriage is not an undue interference by society or authority, nor the imposition of a form. It's the interior requirement of the covenant of conjugal love. In other words, conjugal love requires that it be indissoluble. Exclusive. Fruitful. That's the only way it's going to be properly conjugal love. By conjugal, we mean total. And therefore, the conjugal act will have to have the same properties. And thus, fit it, only given to one. And only realized within the context of that conjugal love, which involves a commitment for life. Right? The only place in which that self-giving is really true. And therefore, it's not something, if we said that freedom is fundamentally freedom for the good, these requirements of marriage, that it be indissoluble, that it be exclusive, that it be complementary and open to life, are not impositions on our will, but actually requirements that enable our will to reach its target. In other words, they're conditions that enable us to realize what we have written into us by being spousal creatures. They're what enable us not to be frustrated irrevocably. Now, so this is written into man's nature at creation. History shows us that marriage, understood in this way, the reality of history very often deviates from what marriage is and is meant to be, and right from the beginning. In fact, Genesis 4 gives us the first mention of polygamy, and it's Lamech, the great-great-great-great-grandson of Cain, is said to be the first polygamist. But despite its antiquity, despite its geographical spread, it's radically contrary to the very notion of a total self-gift. And therefore, it's always and everywhere contrary to the requirements, we could say, of spousal love understood as total self-gift. John Paul II says, such a communion is radically contradicted by polygamy. This, in fact, directly negates the plan of God, which was revealed from the beginning, because it is contrary to the equal personal dignity of men and women who in matrimony give themselves with a love that is total and therefore unique and exclusive. And it's obvious that polygamy fosters jealousy, and we see that in Scripture, for example, in Sarah and Hagar. And every other instance that we encounter polygamy, biblically, we see the terrible consequences that often last generations and generations afterwards. Now, this may not yet be a pressing issue in our country, but down the road, there's no doubt that it will be, because of the influence of Islam and desires to have a Sharia law observed and so in many parts of the world, this is a huge problem. Now, obviously, the same thing, though, is true with regard. So polygamy attacks the exclusivity. Divorce attacks the indissolubility, and that's a plague in our society directly. Let's look at the property of openness to life, fecundity. Now, the church teaches that marriage has two fundamental ends, procreation and union. And it's God's will that those two be inseparably tied together. So we speak of the unitive and the procreative ends of marriage. And just as in a way similar to what Jesus says, what God has joined together, let not man separate. Well, we can say the same thing here. God has joined together these two ends, the unitive and the procreative. Let not man try to rend them asunder, to separate them. And this is the fundamental teaching of Humanae Vitae. And before that, Gaudium et Spes, Second Vatican Council, speaks about as a mutual gift of two persons, this intimate union and the good of the children impose total fidelity on the spouses and argue for an unbreakable oneness between them. In other words, the mission of paternity, procreation, and the mission of education of children requires that the parents have a union. In other words, openness to life involves a mission that involves not just that one moment, but a whole life. Because a human person comes into the world immensely needy. and needy, not just materially, but above all emotionally and spiritually. Right? So the human person needs a home in which to learn to be human, and that home needs to actually be there, not just for a short time, but throughout their life insofar as is possible. And so you can see that union and procreation go together, because in order to fulfill the mission of openness to life, there needs to be a profound union between the spouses. And that union has to be complementary. In other words, the union, first in generation and then in education, has to involve the union of two complementary aspects, the gift of maternity and the gift of paternity. And the children, in order to come to the world, need both of those gifts, and in order to suitably grow, they need the combination of those two gifts. And so procreation involves a mission that lasts basically for life, at least potentially. And so children can only be properly reared and educated in a stable home in which they learn love from the love of their parents. Now, obviously, that's not to say if a child loses a parent, he can't learn love, but he'll learn it probably from other couples. Yeah. In other words, spousal love is the principal way by which we learn, really, the divine love. And anyway, so that union, the key point here is that the unitive end and the procreative end are inseparably bound together. That in order to procreate, you need a union of two, and in order to suitably educate, you need that union of two for life. And then, the very mission of paternity and maternity requires this joint cooperation that binds the spouses together. Now, again, that's not to say that a couple who couldn't have children can't be bound together. But they'll be bound together probably by realizing some form of spiritual maternity-paternity. In other words, just as man is by nature a spousal creature, even if you don't get married, likewise, man by nature has a maternal or paternal mission, even if you don't get married. And in fact, in someone who embraces celibacy for the sake of the kingdom can have an augmented spiritual maternity-paternity. Precisely by renouncing the physical, one doesn't renounce the spiritual, but can have it more intensely. So this union is ordered to fruitfulness. And so the couple, and these are the words here of John Paul II, the couple, while giving themselves to one another, give not just themselves, but also the reality of children. And so the potential child is the fruit of that mutual self-gift. And that mirrors the divine love, because the divine love, in totally pouring itself out of the world, is supremely fruitful, creating the world. In other words, the divine love, by its very nature, is fruitful. Everything that exists is the fruit of the divine love. And so it's fitting that human love be given a share in that fruitfulness. And again, physically or spiritually. Now, in Paul VI, when he wrote on contraception, in Humanae Vitae, he states the Church's teaching with regard to contraception using these categories of unitive and procreative end. And so he says, the Church's teaching on contraception is based on the inseparable connection established by God, which man in his own initiative may not break, between the unitive significance and the procreative significance, which are both inherent in the marriage act. I'm on page 7, halfway down. So he's saying that the conjugal act has to, can't separate by man's own deliberate intention the unitive and the procreative dimensions or significance of it. And the key here is obviously many people have a great difficulty understanding this, right? So surveys show us that perhaps 90% of Catholics don't follow this teaching. But it's not a small matter, because this lies at the heart of understanding marriage, self-gift, and even having a society that continues into future generations. For example, in Europe, because of contraception and abortion, that society is actually dying out. And within some generations, will perhaps no longer exist in the way that we know it. No one part of the Bible, of the gospel can be eliminated without consequences. And so here too, this precept about contraception can't be disregarded without profound consequences for all of society. And you may not see it right away, but future generations will see it. Or will not see it because they won't exist. Anyway, the key to understanding this teaching on contraception and on marriage is really that the conjugal act is a sacred act. And the reason why it's a sacred act is because it's meant to be the reflection of divine love, and it's the way by which a new human person comes into being, and every human person is a sacred reality made in the image and likeness of God. And in fact, it's a way in which, on the natural order, we participate with God in the most intense way possible, in a way that even the angels can't participate. Now, that's odd. Angels have a higher nature than human beings. But precisely because of their higher nature, being pure spirits, angels can't cooperate in the creation of another angel. And that's because an angel, being a pure spirit, can only be made out of nothing. And only God can make a being out of nothing. So just as our soul, likewise a spiritual reality, God has to make it out of nothing. But our bodies, being a physical reality, is made out of other bodies. And that's where our parents come in. Because we're composed of body and soul, the origin of every human being is in some sense dual. Our bodies come from our parents, and our soul is created out of nothing by God. And thus, because we have bodies, we can participate with God in the creation of another human being, supplying the body. God supplies the soul, forms in substantial union. Whereas the angels, being pure spirits, can't do that. And so that's an awesome thing, because that... somebody might say, well, rabbits do that. But what do rabbits cooperate in producing? Not a spiritual being. Not someone created in the image and likeness of God, another rabbit. But only human beings can cooperate with God in the creation of another person made in the image and likeness of God with an eternal destiny, capable of friendship with God. And so that's an awesome mission. And therefore, that act by which that's done, in other words, that act by which life is potentially transmitted, is clearly a sacred act. And therefore, what do? With sacred things? We protect them, right? We protect them precisely by separating them from their sacredness being lost. So, for example, sacred vessels. What do? With the Eucharist? I mean, we put it in the tabernacle. We don't just leave it around anywhere because it's sacred, and therefore it has to be kept apart from other things. And likewise, the marital act, because it transmits life, has to be separated out. And it's separated precisely by marriage. We said that's the place in which it has its true meaning. That's the only place in which it can be the sensible sign of a total spiritual self-giving. Because that's the only place in which that total spiritual self-giving exists, is within marriage. And so the conjugal act, because it's sacred, has to be only used within marriage. And not only used within marriage, it also, even within marriage, it has to always be open to life so that it can retain that sacredness of potentially transmitting life. All right, it may happen that it's not the fertile period, in which case I can foresee that it won't transmit life. But still, it's by its very nature open to that and therefore still sacred. But it wouldn't be the same if I deliberately closed it to life by an act on my part using contraception.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to terminate Dr. Feingold's lecture at that point. We have been listening to Dr. Lawrence Feingold, professor of theology at Kendrick Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri, speaking on the sacrament of matrimony. And Dr. Feingold, as I mentioned at the outset of the show, is another enthusiastic Jewish convert to the Catholic Church and inserts in his discussion a very special sensitivity to an understanding of matrimony coming from the pre-Christian covenant between God and man, coming from Judaism. And also, as I mentioned at the outset of the show, one of my reasons for wanting to dedicate today's show to matrimony is precisely because this holy divine institution that God has given mankind to reflect the relationship between Christ and the Church, to reflect the love that God has for mankind, to in fact reflect the love that is contained within the persons of the Most Holy Trinity, that this incredibly holy gift that God has given mankind is under blasphemous assault like never before in civilized history. And so perhaps you will join me in including that in our prayer intentions, that the divine, sacred nature and meaning of matrimony be preserved and not be lost, and also that the attack on matrimony not be used as a front in a broader attack on Christianity and on the Catholic Church. So, with that, perhaps a bit sober reflection, I will sign off for now. You've been listening to Salvationists from the Jews on Radio Maria, and this is Roy Shulman, and I hope you join us again next week. Bye for now.